Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast where we chat to some interesting and inspiring women. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Amanda Prowse. Hello, Amanda.
Hello. Bit daunted because I don't think I'm either influential or interesting, but let's see how we go.
Oh, well, everyone else will find you entirely that. Amanda Prowse is one of the UK's most prolific authors and a writer of contemporary fiction with outstanding online reviews, multiple awards, and 30 bestsellers. So, Amanda, get you. Wow. And welcome. Where have you been locked down?
Oh, well, do you know, in some ways, obviously, like everyone else, it's been pretty horrific. I felt very lonely. But in terms of environment, I'm locked away in my farmhouse in the West Country. So actually, my life hasn't changed very much on a day-to-day basis because I'm always in my pyjamas, tip-tapping away in a corner somewhere with the rest of the world going on outside. So, I've been here with chickens, a couple of pigs, goats, dogs, more humans than I'm used to having around, I must admit, as everyone's gravitated home, which is lovely. But so we've been steadily going nuts and driving each other crazy. And everything that brought me joy at the beginning is now no longer doing that. Who wants to make bread? Not me.
It's entirely normal by the sounds of it. And you're in the attic, which is the first signs of madness, isn't it? But you've got this fabulous studio. I'm very jealous of that. Yes, I know what you mean. The highs are definitely higher, aren't they? And the lows are definitely lower. So we all feel a bit nuts. But you've got your writing and that's kept you sane, has it?
Do you know, it has. And I think it's one thing about when you can write. So I grew up in a house without any books in a very large, busy family where there was no space. And I was always used to sort of curling away in a corner with a book from the library. And that was my escape, my salvation, my education, my everything, really. And writing is no different as a grown-up. I do just the same. I shut myself away. And I think it does keep me sane because I can literally escape into wherever I want to be. So one minute I'm sitting in a rainy West Country. Next thing I'm on a beach in Australia. How lovely.
Oh, how amazing. Wouldn't we all like to be? It's so cathartic though, isn't it, writing? And actually journaling. I've interviewed people before that say with journaling, if you write 3 pages every day, but without taking your pen off the page, so you can repeat the same word or do the same word over and over again until the subconscious starts, that it's just so good for you as well. So that is actually what you're doing every day, but journaling for a very long time, aren't you? And it's been a long 15 months, hasn't it? It really has.
I, you know, I love the idea of that, journaling in that way. Kind of, it's almost like a sort of written mantra, a written sort of what do you call it? Not an assignation. What do you call it when you sit and you a chant is the word I'm looking for.
It is. It's meditative, because if you take the pen off the paper, it allows you to think. And if you don't take the pen off the paper, then any old ramble comes out and it's fine because no one else will read it. But I just always remembered it. And at the moments during lockdown when I was particularly stressed, as we all went through, I just did it, you know, occasionally. And actually, it's amazing what comes out, isn't it?
I love that. I really do. And actually, when people say to me, how do I start writing and I want to write, I say something very similar. Just start. Write anything. Don't think about writing a blockbuster or a family saga or being the next JK. Just literally write a word, a sentence, a paragraph, a list, a memory, a smell, and let it grow like knitting. And I guess it's a similar thing, isn't it? Almost giving into the process.
Yes, that it's within you. But I think people are very scared, aren't they? You know, I'd love to write a book, but I think fiction is very, very difficult. And to find characters and not get everything jumbled up, it's amazing, amazing. So do you have a formula for your writing? I know you write very fast, very often and very successfully.
It's a weird one. So I have always, as I say, been an amazing book lover. I'm not incredibly educated, but books just taught me there was this whole other universe I could dive into when things were good, when things were bad. And I've always been an avid reader. And books always fell into two camps for me. I'd either think I can do better than that, or gosh, I wish I'd written that. And that they were the sort of, that's how I sort of defined all my reading. And it wasn't till I was 42, I think it was, I'm 53 now. So 42, I finally thought, you know what, I'm going to have a go. But I didn't realize this doesn't happen to everyone, but my books arrive in my head very, very quickly and fully formed. So that's a secret, Nikki, to why I can write so quickly, because I don't have to ponder a plot or try and picture what he's wearing or where she went or what her accent was, because they're downloaded into my head almost like a movie and it happens in seconds.
But all the characters and everything.
Everything. Beginning, middle, end, twist, turns. Everything. So then all I have to do is literally look above like I'm seeing it for the first time, and I type and I write. So it's almost like if I said to you, write the story of Dirty Dancing, you would instantly in your, because we all know that film, you would instantly in your head start running it and you would write, oh, and he walks into the room. And that's exactly what I do. I see the film and I write it. And I thought that happened to everybody.
No, gosh, no such luck. But what happened? What at 42, what was the trigger moment?
I got cancer. Oh. And I thought, you know what? This is my one time round the block. It changed my life. It changes all our lives. We've all been touched by it. We all know the horrors of it. We all know how terrible it is. But actually, I also say it was one of the best things that happened to me in a weird way, because it made me realise it was my one time round the block. And what I'd always wanted to do was write that book. And I thought, do you know what? I'm going to have a go. And I did.
Oh, my goodness. Good for you. And how wonderful, you know, that there was a happy ending to that, because so many people, you know, are going through hell in lockdown. Yeah. And, you know, writing can obviously help. And how you've turned it round. It's amazing. Amazing. So I read your writing was described as heartfelt, and you see plots, like you say, movies in your mind. And you obviously have said you want them to be addictive, don't you?
I think that's, for me, that is always when I put a book down, if I'm still thinking about the main character when I'm washing up or just before I fall asleep, or I'm worried if I leave them in some kind of jeopardy before I nod off, I always think, oh gosh, I can't wait till tomorrow to get back to it. And that kind of addictive nature of the prose, I think could be really, that's always what I aim to achieve, because I think that's what I want in a good book.
Definitely, definitely. I know you've said, you know, you love the characters to resonate with the audience and you don't want people to turn the light off at night. And do you have fans who read all of your books and who write to you?
Do you know what, Nikki? I consider it to be the most incredible privilege. I think I've sold something like 14 million books in 22 countries. It's absolutely staggering. In 10 years, it's my life is a fairy story, really. It's mind-blowing. But I have people who have been with me from the very, very beginning who read the first book, Poppy Day. And I could name them all to you now. There's a core of about 30 of them. But of course, we've gathered more readers on the way. Of course we have. And then people, if they're reading me for the first time today, will go back and read the back catalogue. And they tell me what they like best. And they tell me what characters they love. And they... But do you know what? It's a strange thing. I they've gone from being readers to being my friends. And writing is a very solitary business. I often feel quite lonely, particularly during lockdown. I've really missed company or watching people or being in a coffee shop or, you know, seeing your mates and those little things that make a real big difference. I felt very lonely at times. And just having someone, a message pop into my inbox, say, oh, hi, Mandy, you know, just to let you know, I've just read this one and I loved when she did this. And oh, I didn't like that bit. And why did he do that to her? And blah, blah. And I think, oh, my gosh, really? They're investing in it. And but it's like chatting with my mates. I absolutely love it. And it's such a privileged position to have people who stay with you for every book and taking the journey with me. They've seen my success, my highs, my lows. They've taken every step with me as well as my characters.
How fantastic. It's like a little family. And have you met any of them? Or I suppose you haven't been able to in lockdown. But
I've met lots of my readers. I used to do a lot more events, obviously, well, before lockdown. But also I made a real effort to try and get to people whose opinions I care about and who have not only invested their money in my books, but their time. Yes. You know, we're talking about women who are busy working jobs or raising kids or looking after a house or caring for partners or parents or whatever. And they give me the honour of spending 12 hours or whatever it is in my head, just absolutely going, giving themselves over to my... And I think that is the most incredible privilege. So I love to meet my readers and just basically say thank you, because, as I say, it's the most incredible feeling to feel supported in that way. And they show me love and I love them in return.
Oh, how fabulous. And how successful you've been. It's just incredible. And you've already released one earlier this year in February, An Ordinary Life. I like how you've said about the book Ordinary Life that when we age, and you were looking at observing someone elderly, that they think that their stories are ordinary, but to others they're not. They're incredible, aren't they? And that's so true, isn't it?
Everybody you meet, it doesn't matter what role they're in or what their life is, where they live, how they live, everybody I think has something really interesting to tell you, you know. And there's someone in the little farming hamlet where we live, and I see this particular gentleman when I'm out walking, and he has, you know, he has not much to say. He talks about the weather. And then every so often, he'll tell me something incredible about his garden that I learn. And I come back and look at my garden and think, okay, so now I know how to do that. He has no idea that he's imparting this incredible wisdom. He's just passing the time of day. But when he's telling me what what he's done with his runner beans or how he gets bumper tomatoes. I'm thinking, you're so smart. You know how to do this.
And it's important now, isn't it? Because all we've got is our gardens and our homes and today, isn't it? Which is so surreal. If we're lucky. Is that so true? And these people are, you know, they're extraordinary rather than ordinary, aren't they?
I think particularly the war stories. When you read people who went through the war, which obviously was the most defining event, my own grandparents spoke about it all the time because it was their great, exciting adventure, including all the horrors. But they're in the East End of London, you know, their streets got bombed and, you know, we all know those stories. But it was absolutely fascinating to hear that firsthand. And to them, they said, oh, well, we just got on with it. We just got on with it. And I'm saying, you know, my grandma told me a story of coming up. She worked in a factory where the Barbican's now sited, came up, looked out, and she couldn't find a single landmark by which to walk home because it was all gone. Oh. Everything was on fire. Okay. And she said, oh, yeah. So I just took my time and, you know, got my brolly out. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh.
Gosh, amazing. That's going to be us in the future talking about the corona stories and when we and our children, you know, because actually it's harrowing and it's unreal that it's real, isn't it? And it will become a huge story. Now, we'll talk about your new one soon. But do you ever sleep? I hear you write for 15 hours a day. Is that true?
I'm obsessed with it, Nikki. You know how when you're doing a craft project or you're knitting or you're scrapbooking or you're painting and someone says, oh, can you know, what's for supper? And you have to abandon what you're doing and go and do. That's how I feel about my job. Real life just gets in the way. Yes. You know, if there's laundry waiting to be hung out, you know, or dogs to be fed.
Don't they say, we'll cook for you because you're in doing this masterpiece?
They do sometimes, but they don't think they're masterpieces. It's really interesting. Obviously, I'm just their mum and their wife and their daughter and their sister. So, you know, normal life doesn't stop just because I happen to be, you know, creating a book. Then I think they all find it quite mysterious. And I remember we got interviewed by a journalist that the whole family a few years ago in the book, my boys who are now in their mid-20s were in their teens. And someone said, so, you know, have you ever read your mum's books? They went, no. It was like almost...
Well, they haven't. No,
of course
no,
not. And it was really funny because I thought it's interesting, isn't it? Because if my kids wrote a workbook,
it's grounded.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it, Nikki. I thought my life would be like Barbara Cartland laying there having grapes peeled, but on a chaise lounge. Not quite.
No, that's her making up a story. Oh, dear. So it's a bit like food fasting, 9 hours sleep, 15 hours writing. So you've revealed your age very kindly there about when you began. I mean, that's amazing. So many novels in less than 10 years. That's 33 novels and shorter novellas in only 9 years. I mean, it must be two or three a year, is it, that you're literally churning them out? Wow, you found a success formula.
I finish one at midday on, you know, the Tuesday, and I might have a cup of coffee, but already the next one is battering to get out my head. So it's like a compulsion. So I literally will send that one off and I will just start the next one because I have them. I have my next probably 20 book literally in my head.
Oh, my goodness, I feel bad that I'm interrupting now.
No, not at all. It's very good for me to stop.
Gosh, amazing. And I wish a whole book would just pop into my head. It's sort of, you don't get writer's block then. You've won multiple awards, achieved great online reviews, the Sainsbury's eBook of the Year Award for A Mother's Story, and number one in literary fiction for The Food of Love, and described by the Daily Mail as the queen of family drama. Is that true in all aspects of your life?
My husband says they mean drama queen, not family drama, because I do tend to be a bit dramatic. It's lovely, isn't
they
it?
They are nice.
Lovely.
So, but drama obviously interests you. Is it the sort of discovery, the romance, the motherhood, any particular aspect that, no, it's just as it comes to your...
Do you know what, Nikki? When I first started writing and I thought I really, really want to write a book, the thing that put me off starting was because I grew up in a house without a spare bedroom. We didn't have any books. My mum thought the height of cordon bleu cooking was a Fray Bentos pie. And I thought, people who write books, they've been to Mallorca. You know, they know stuff. I've never done anything. I've never been anywhere. I've never climbed a mountain. What am I going to write about? And then I realised, exactly full circle what we were talking about before, it's ordinary life. It's all of our stories are unique and interesting. So I just write what I know, which is a slice of family life with all the things we all go through, whether it's, you know, I'm a bit fat, whether it's being in debt, whether it's, you know, worrying about your kids, whether it's loss, grief, heartache, falling in love, all the things that make the rich tapestry of every one of our lives. And we all think are unique to us. Of course, they're not. They're just they are life. Yeah. And I write about that. Ordinary families like yours, mine, like everyone's. Really? And what we all
that's
go through.
Everyone so loves it. And that's why...
Because they can relate to it, I think, Nikki. You know, I think it's relatable.
Definitely. And you loved writing as a little girl, as you say. You read Enid Blyton, Black Beauty by Anna Sewell, Carrie's War, and later, you know, to love stories, Thornbirds, and things that influenced your writing. So you're very romantic, aren't you? So let's talk about your new book. Congratulations. It's called Waiting to Begin, came out on the 8th of June. It's your 27th book that isn't a novella. Fantastic. So tell us about it. Waiting to Begin what?
So Waiting to Begin is Bessie's story. And I don't know about you, but I've always been the sort of person that when I'm, you know, washing up or putting the laundry out or just having a little think in the bath, which is where I cry. When I need to cry, I get in the bath because it's the only room with a lock on it. So that's the only place I go.
A private one, yes.
Exactly. And sometimes I sit there and think, oh, I wonder what would have happened if, or what would I have done if I'd said yes to that or no to this or taken a different route or a different bus or a different whatever. And I think we all tend to, well, I certainly have those, not regrets, but reflections on what my life was like when I was a teenager, when I felt invincible. And when I was 16, I honestly thought that I could take over the world, and I thought I'd be married to David Cassidy.
Yes. Oh, yes. Why not?
Neither of those things happened, I should point out. Some would say, thankfully. But I think we all have this, we feel invincible. We have this passion for life. And suddenly, life happens. You're on a hamster wheel and you're paying the rent and you're paying a mortgage and you're worrying about schools and crime and, you know, the global economy and the planet and how we make things better for everyone, you know, the kids. And suddenly you're just doing it and you're not being it. You're just on this treadmill. And Bessie, certainly, the book is set in 2 days, her 16th birthday, when she feels like the world is at her feet, and her 53rd birthday, where she's hanging on to her marriage by a thread. She's not happy. She's unfulfilled. And we learn it's because of what happened to Bess, primarily on her 16th birthday. She carries this secret with her. But actually, at the end, and I'm not really giving anything away, yes. Bess realises that the only thing that's changed is her. It's her outlook. It's her belief that she can change the world, that she can do stuff, that she can make a difference. But the small things are the big things. You know, having a cup of tea with someone you love, that's the big stuff.
I think you're so right. I think, and as you get, you know, older and become a parent, obviously like we both are, you realise that it is, and we reinforce that to our teenagers and say, you know, it is the little things that are the big things when you look back, isn't it? It definitely is. And, you know, waiting to begin, laughing.
The way you laugh when you're a teenager till you're wetting yourself.
I know.
Nothing's ever that funny, Nikki.
I know, and we're yearning for that, for something to make it that funny, finding happiness and whatever. And everyone's particularly yearning for that at the moment in lockdown. We're questioning everything and work and relationships and where we want to live and what we want to do with our lives, aren't we? And none of us have got the answers. And but they can all relate to your book and how that initial magic and obsession in love and life can change, can't it? And we're thinking, actually, we didn't think our life was going to pan out quite the way it is. What are we going to do about the bit we've got left?
So I saw a very funny quote the other day. Someone put it on the internet and it said, I wish I'd paid more attention to my maths teacher. He never told me I was going to have to be teaching my kid maths during a plague. And I thought, there you go. We didn't need to know, you know, how many buses Michael was going to take to get to the, you know, what we needed to know was that. Maybe we'd have all listened to algebra a bit more.
We would. If we went back, I think we would be different, wouldn't we? With so much uncertainty. Goodness me. So the world is on pause, and that's probably making all sorts of new thoughts and new books and so much uncertainty. We wanted to surprise the listeners with you as the author reading an excerpt of your new book called Waiting to Begin, if that's okay. So would you mind turning to page 23 and the last paragraph of your book to set the scene? And we are with your 53-year-old self, or Bessie's self. And just read that, please.
She watched him leave the room and remembered her husband when the gold band on her finger had been shiny and loose, crawling up under the duvet, kissing her foot, her leg, mad for her and so in love, like she filled him up, like she was enough. She swallowed the lump in her throat, knowing she had felt that way too. It had been enough. But they had started married life as a couple, heading out hand in hand on a great adventure, joint captains at the prow of their ship. Now it was as if they were tethered, but slightly adrift, bobbing on a vast, endless ocean without direction, and on a lilo that was slowly deflating. And the hiss of escaping air filled the quiet moments when words were wanting.
I like that. And that sets the scene of how a lot of people must be feeling, you know, disillusion or disappointment or unhappy and not sure what to do about it, and particularly now in lockdown and thinking, you know, there was a rise and surge of divorces in France and various countries in, you know, lockdown one, and how people can reshape their future. So I think that's a brilliant sort of reflection on how people are feeling.
But you know, it's interesting, just like we were talking about how I started writing, it took an interruption in my life to make me change course, change my career, not that I had a, you know, great career, but change and really follow my dreams. And I think this is another forced interruption that means it reevaluation of, as you said, every aspect of our lives. And I, for one, have never spent so much time with my husband. Yeah. And I fluctuate between I fluctuate between feeling incredibly thankful that I have him and wanting to hit him over the head with a blunt instrument. I think that's normal.
I think it is normal in terms of, you know, spending too much time with anyone, even yourself, is too much, isn't it? And actually, I read a brilliant quote this morning from Britta Fernandez-Schmidt, who I've interviewed recently, the Women for Women International. And she's going through heartache at the moment with her mum very ill in hospital, bless her. And she had said, everything that happens in your life is an emergence of something new. And I thought, actually, that was a beautiful way of looking at it, wasn't it?
I adore that so much, because that is exactly right. We are all in this constantly evolving chrysalis. Who knows what we're going to emerge as? And this is the thing, Waiting to Begin is the title, because we need to allow ourselves to start. Definitely. Women need to give themselves permission to say, right, I'm coming out now, and this is what I want to be.
That's so
I want to be a writer. I want to live by the sea. I want to paint. I want to ice skate. I want to travel. I want to be alone. We need to give ourselves permission, because too many women that I speak to, including my readers, there is a long list of priorities in their home, in their head, in their life. Yeah. And literally, they are at the very, very bottom.
Which they mustn't do. And actually, some of the people I've interviewed as well have said, you know, be more selfless, because selfless isn't, you know, it actually isn't selfish to think of yourself. And also something else I read, a quote that said, life is suffering and it's finding the meaning in the suffering. And I thought, gosh, that was really deep, but so important for people right now. Actually, you know, that life isn't always roses and hunky-dory and everything's fabulous and are you happy? And I think actually, even as I've got older, the question, are you happy, it isn't a sort of permanent state, is it? It's a fluctuating state, and otherwise it wouldn't be worth it.
That is very, very important, because I think people sometimes do feel that they should reach happiness like it's a destination and that's where I'm going to stay. I've got the best table in the house and I'm not moving. I'm just going to sit here. And it doesn't work like that. I describe life as a roller coaster. I feel like I'm constantly in a swamp, trying to get to the other side where joy lurks, just hoping I get to the other side without losing a flip-flop. I mean, that is really my life. Yeah. And I hang on to those great moments of joy, because for me, that's what fuels the downtime. And there are downtimes.
Definitely. Gratitude. Oh, gosh, of course. And particularly at the moment. And knowing that it's okay to not be okay, but tomorrow will be better. Or that actually, you know, a lot of us are lucky for a lot of things and to find that. So we'll be helping a lot of people.
Don't you find, Nikki, also that as you get older, I find that I used to think that things that would make me happy. So if I had a spare bedroom, if I had, you know, two walks, if I had a garden, if I had a dog, everything. Next year, when I'm 50, when I'm 20, when I'm 18, everything's good. And it doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't happen like that.
Is the now.
But we've got to find happiness now in today for the little joys, I think is what it comes down to. And actually, comparison with anybody else is the route to unhappiness, because we don't know what else is really bugging them, whatever they've got.
Do you know what, Nikki? I just let you know that you can probably see my mascara is looking a little bit smudgy. I've spent the last hour and a half before I came in here just in tears.
Oh, bless you. I'm so sorry. I hope it wasn't me.
Sometimes life feels a little bit overwhelming.
Oh,
look at me.
Gosh,
smiling.
You look fantastic. And you just.
There we go.
That was yesterday's makeup. And actually,
it is yesterday's.
Grumpy this morning because this truck driver parked outside just as I was picking up on my microphone. And I was thinking, oh dear. But when I chat and go on Zoom and talk to completely people I don't know, complete strangers, and then have a lovely chat like this, hopefully it comes across to our listeners that actually we're having a good time. We're cheering each other up. We're actually talking about the world, and actually it's all okay. and we're all fine and doing really well.
So very important though to know that this presentation, if you caught me half an hour earlier, it would have sounded, I would have felt very different. And that's good because I think that's real.
It's time. It is real. And I did say to you, I'm so sorry, I haven't got my makeup on this morning. So actually we are being real. We're not all sort of fabricated and polished and looking. We're all hot and sweaty and grumpy and having a good time. So your new book has been described as a breathtaking, heartwarming novel about courage, hope and redemption of one woman facing her past to reclaim the love and the life she was destined for. That's so exciting and inspiring, isn't it? So brilliant. Good luck with that. Now, we've related to that and you've said about your data, 22 countries, 12 languages, millions and millions. How many did you say? 40 million sales.
Nearly 14, yeah.
14 million. Unbelievable. And you must be proud of yourself.
I am proud of myself, but not because of that. I'm proud of myself because I've got two really great kids.
Oh, bless you.
I've got two amazing boys who haven't had the easiest of times. And I'm really proud of my mumming, my mumship. I love it.
Your mumship.
They're my thing.
And you did say to me this morning, how are your babies? And I said, well, they're 19 and nearly 17. And it's so true. And in fact, we were going to talk about your lovely son, who I did see his arm because he was handing you microphones and helping you with the tech. Bless him. Amongst your fiction bestsellers was your first nonfiction, co-written with your lovely son, who was facing depression. Bless him. So, and the boy between. Do you want to just touch on that briefly?
Well, it's weird for me because I can tell you hand on heart that despite cancer, debt, all the things that have, you know, come and visited in my life, I've always been happy. I've always been relatively upbeat, a real glass half full kind of gal. So I thought depression was always that. Is that just feeling a bit off? Is that having a bad day? Is that just let's go for a walk and you'll feel better? I didn't understand what it was because I'd never experienced it and I'd never seen it firsthand. So I probably doubted it existed because I'd never seen it or touched it. And that's my luck. You know, that's absolutely my luck. There's no other reason than that. My son, my beautiful boy, Josh is, you know, a strapping 6'2", bearded, hairy, rugby playing monster who's the kindest, sweetest, loyalist boy on the planet, in my view. Sailed through school academically, super smart. I was so proud. Josh is going to be a doctor. Josh is going to be an astronaut. Josh is going to be a sculptor, an artist, a cowboy, a lawyer. All these amazing hopes for this boy who can take over the world and just run with it. And I was so excited for his future. Josh went off to university. And I was working in Australia for a couple of months. And my husband called me to tell me that Josh had tried to take his own life. And it's one of those things, Nikki, that it's still, this was in 2016.
Oh my goodness.
It still doesn't feel real. It never will.
Yeah.
Because I will never, ever be able to understand the point you get to where you just would rather not be. I will never understand it. I understand the illness that makes him see the world in that way. I understand his illness, depression, which puts a veil over the world and reality and skews things for Josh. But it was a real journey of learning. And I said to Josh, I came home, obviously, and we watched him 24 hours. We slept with him. We laid on his floor. We held his hand and brought him back from the brink. And I said to him one day, I don't know what to do to help you. I don't know what this is. I don't know what's going on. How do I help you? And he said, if I'm having a bad day, come into my room, open the window, pull back my duvet, change my pillow, bring me a cup of tea. And I said, oh, what? Like you're ill. He said, Mum, I am ill. And I realized that it was just like when I got cancer, when I got sick, it's exactly the same. My boy is ill, but he suffers with a mental illness, which filled me with horror, not because of the shame or the stigma of it, because there shouldn't be any, but because I genuinely, Nikki, did not know where to go or what to do. Where's the tablet? Where's the retreat? Who's the doctor? Where's the magic cream for that? What's the treatment? What do we do? How do we fix you? And I went headlong into fix-it mode. Fix it, fix it. And you can't fix it. You can only be there and support Josh through the darker days. And so we wrote this book together. It's not a self-help book. There's no moment at the end where we pop a champagne cork and yay, everything's glorious and happy. And now we're on a beach, isn't it fab? And I learned very early on that people never said, oh, I had a bit of depression. they say, I battle depression. I live with depression. I struggle with depression. And so I knew it was going to be a long journey. And that filled me with, I was petrified. I still am petrified.
Yes.
Because I know how things can turn on a penny. Awesome. But this book is just a slice of our experience. It's what it was like to find Josh in that state when I got home. It more or less goes through Josh's school life and some of the things that we think were red flags for us in his upbringing, to the point where he is now, which is at home where we can keep him safe and keep an eye on him for the time being. And how we got here, how we've come out of the other side of him not wanting to be here. Is he fixed? No. Will he ever be fixed? Probably not. Is it something you can fix? I don't know. But it's just, but the point is actually, Nikki, and just for a real high, because it isn't all bad, Josh has a fantastic life with depression. He is wonderful. He has a great group of friends. He has so much potential. He laughs a lot. He enjoys good food, countryside, his dogs, his family. He has a great life. Yeah. It's just that behind one door, just lurking, is this nasty illness that can sometimes and often does pull the rug from under him, but it doesn't define him.
Gosh, thank you for sharing that, Amanda. That's just heart-wrenching. And, you know, I literally felt like I'd been kicked in the stomach in the solar plexus when you said that. It was just so brave of you to share, and how amazing and how thankful we are that he is okay. And we saw him this morning, but goodness me, and so many people, particularly in these times, and the mental health of you know, my daughter's gone to university and they all caught coronavirus, and how they've all had to tackle things and have that mental health and the pandemic on their own. It's just horrendous.
I didn't know anyone that was going through it. I thought, and you know, the funny thing is, Nikki, I would have told you before this happened that if you'd said to me, what kind of parent are you? I'd have thought, well, actually, I'm a really good one. I know everything about my kids. I eat dinner with them. I go on holiday with them. I know their friends. They text me when they arrive. They know to put on a vest if it's cold. I have got this absolutely nailed. Smug mum. You know, the mums you meet in the supermarket who say, oh, how are your children? And then instantly launch into what theirs are doing. That's me.
Yes.
My kids are amazing. I was so smug.
Amazing.
I was getting it right.
You were, and you're still getting it right. But the world and you know, social media and all of these dark things and male, you know, suicide and male depression has largely gone so unnoticed, but it's now on the radar. And thank goodness there have been footballers on TV and the stigma has been smashed. And to say, sometimes we feel like hell, it's so important to talk. And I've walked past people in the park.
Josh always says, Nikki, Josh has this message and he says it can and usually does get better. So the point is, it's not that Josh tried to take his life on that day. It's that the next day he didn't want to.
Exactly.
And then the day after that, he did. And then the day after that, he didn't. And that was how the pattern went on until the days between the times when he wanted to got bigger and bigger.
Okay.
And that's really, really important for anyone whose child, partner, themselves, if they're struggling, just you really need to hold on. Just hold on, because it will pass. It can pass.
Exactly. And to tell people because of how dark you're feeling, because that must be so frightening. And how brave and how amazing that he wrote that book with you to help others. And, you know, at his age, in his early 20s, that is a phenomenal thing to do. And bless him. Good luck to him. And, and you are being an amazing mum. Gosh, and this podcast, and that's why we do this, the Influential Women podcast. We chat to inspiring women like yourself about their work, their life, real human issues, influences, and their mantra. I'll ask you about it in a minute. But adversity or setbacks they've overcome, and you've overcome a lot, you know, from cancer you had talked about, and that changed your life with writing Poppy Day in 2012 on the 11th of November for that occasion. And then your son battling this. So you've really shared your adversity. So which strong women or men have inspired you? I'm sure your son, Josh Hartley, has.
Definitely. I mean, definitely Josh is one of my heroes. And my other son, Ben, too, because he quietly goes about life living in a house where depression lives. And he's very overlooked because everyone is focusing on Josh, who's ill And Ben just very quietly will unstep the dishwasher and be fantastic and make me a cup of tea. And he's the kindest, kindest boy. He's just an absolute, he's a darling. And I'm aware that we don't always give Ben as much attention because we're focusing on the firefighting.
Of course. I think a lot of people could, you know, may beat themselves up or feel guilty for that, because I think in all families, you know, there is a focus or an issue or something that rises where you do focus on different things, you know, with yourself or the other child or schoolwork or exams or whatever it is. And particularly now with homeschooling and people trying to work and keep the house clean, and it's just overwhelming, isn't it? So I don't think anybody should feel guilty. And
I really also, talking about who I admire, I tell you, it's a group of people I admire. It's not one person, but it's nurses on the front line of wards, and it's paramedics, and it's ambulance drivers who deal with things every single day that most of us would not be able to deal with, handle, cope with, or even look at. Yeah. And they're paid less than if you were a manager of a supermarket. I don't understand that. I don't understand how we as a society have decided that's how it should work. That someone who is caring for vulnerable people or people at the end of their life or the elderly or people who are sick, who are doing the most incredible jobs under the most trying of circumstances, I don't know why they're not paid the right amount of money for what they do. They should be all paid, you know, much more.
No, they should be the millionaires. I hope, you know, when this is eventually all over, that will all turn, because they so deserve it. They literally have put their lives at risk, haven't they?
But they, even without the pandemic, you know, if ever you've had someone in end-of-life care who you loved, if ever you've been very ill, if ever you've been to an ICU, if ever you've been to the scene of an accident, you just see these superhumans just go into what's normal for them, and your heart is racing, your adrenaline's pumping, and you just want to run in the opposite direction, and they run towards it and they put their arms around them and they make it better. I mean, I think these people are superhuman. How do you do that?
Amazing, incredible. You know, I've actually been in hospital twice in lockdown 2 and 3, actually, for operations as well. And you just see that they're just so brave and fearless and amazing. So your inspiration, key influence in your life, was your mum one of those? Because I read that she was a Mary Quant model. That's amazing.
You wouldn't think it looking at me, because I'm a 5'3" tubby Oompa Loompa with orange hair right now. My mother is a willowy, slender beauty. She's absolutely lovely. And she came from a very working class, poor East End family. And she has selflessly, it's just really always been about her kids, about her family, about her wider family. She's one of those people that people gravitate to. And she taught me that actually it's very easy to laugh. Laughing is the best thing you can do on a daily basis. So she has always gone out of her way to make situations hilarious. And I always say, Mum, when I have to think about you, when I think about you, I will think about lying in a hospital bed, desperately ill. And she disappeared. And I thought, where's she gone? And she got under the bed just to make me laugh. And a doctor came in, got down on the floor and went, are you okay, Mrs. Smith? She went, oh, yes, sorry, I've just lost something, because she didn't want to say I'm just...
dress outfit on or something.
She's just hilarious. She just always finds something. She's just one of those people, life could have got her down, but it never did. So her strength, I admire her strength, definitely. But I come from a long line of strong East End women, you know, wielding rolling pins and doing menial and manual labour for very low wages. But it didn't stop them being happy, you know? They had great lives.
Happiness is the key. So can we talk about your passions? So how you relax or spend your time off? I believe you're a passionate supporter of military charities and mental health and women's causes. And you've got a bit of a romance story there as well, haven't you? A true romance story that I was going to ask you about.
Yeah. So I was a single mum when Josh's dad and I split up just after I had Josh. So I've been a single mum with Josh until Josh was nearly 8 or 9, I think, when I met Simeon, who is my husband. And Josh had this friend at school, Ben, who used to come home for weekends and come and play. And Ben was a great kid. Didn't like my cooking, still doesn't, but that's okay. But a really lovely, great kid. And he was a pleasure to have in the house. And I'd say, you know, where's your dad then, Ben? Oh, he's a soldier. I thought, oh, you know. And Ben's mum wasn't on the scene. And I went to take the boys to play rugby one day, and I had my dad's old barber on, wellies, no makeup, you know, looked like I've been dragged through several hedges or living in a skip for a month. And this man just walked towards me on the rugby pitch. And I've always said, when people say it was love at first sight, I think, no, it wasn't, you were just drunk. or it was just beer goggles, or you were desperate. That's what I've always thought. This man walked towards me and he was smiling at me. And it was, and I thought, oh, there you are. It was like I knew him. It was like I'd known him. And we just stood there just sort of smiling at each other. He said, I'm Ben's dad. I was like, oh, hello. And that was it. And then he took my number. He said, let's maybe want to take the boys bowling one day. He took my telephone number. And I got back and said to my brothers, Ben's dad's just asked me for my telephone number. And my brother said, oh, maybe he fancies you. I thought, oh, don't be ridiculous. Anyway, the next day, I was so out of practice. I've been my own, not so much as a date or a snog in like a decade. And anyway, he sent me a text and we met in a car park and had a cup of coffee. Trey glam. Outside Marks and Sparks in a car park. Lovely. And we've been together pretty much every day since. And he's just brilliant. I love being married to him. I love it. I love being with him. Oh, he's really nice.
Oh, Simeon, he's called. Let's give him a big shout out then. He's and great. The soldier, he's bless him. Great. But he's been a soldier at home and you support military charities.
Yes. So Simeon's been a soldier since he was 16. He's now 55 and still serving. He's now a colonel. Hello.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. Boy did good. And I do support military charities because I know the reason my husband's come home from 14 tours intact is luck. And the reason so many don't is just bad luck. And I know what it's like to be at home with the kids wondering what's happening. And it can be very isolating. And sadly, there isn't enough done for ex-military personnel who are struggling and their families or people who have lost loved ones or had life-changing injuries. And so we have to raise money through the RBL and through other charities because we need to. We need to supplement it. We need to support those who have done a lot for us. You know, I think that's just a basic. And women's charities, because I also know what it's like to struggle as a single mum, to be on my own. And I always, I was very lucky in that I had the ability to work. I always worked two or three jobs. I was always able to look after myself, but that's not always the case. If English isn't your first language, if you are ill, if you are afraid, if you are injured, if you are depressed, there are loads of reasons why it's not so easy for everyone to do what I did, you know, and I understand that more. Now I'm in a position of stability. I could always just go and get another cleaning job, another, you know, the world isn't like that now. It's hard. And there are women's refuges, small charities who are desperate for funds. And that's what I tend to support, refuges for people who are fleeing from domestic abuse. And I know it happens across gender, but I specifically support ones that are looking after mummies and babies and with kids, things like that, because I think that's important and I relate to it. And lots of small women's charities helping sex workers. You know, sex work is dangerous. It's usually not done because it's glamorous or you have much choice. Very often it's to feed addiction. Very often it's because you're controlled. And so I love supporting charities that help women try and get out of sex addiction. Through a number of things.
Wow, good for you. Gosh, you do some amazing things as a mum and with your family. Brilliant. Good for you. So do you have a mantra for living your life?
I do. And it's very simple. Life begins when you let it.
Oh, waiting to begin. That's so true. Everyone probably listening is waiting to begin. And actually, we all need to let it now, don't we? The time is now. The power is now as well, as the other book says.
Because all we've got, right, is this second. It's all we've got.
I think you're so right. And actually, you know, planning... I was always a massive planner and we can't plan very much now. So we have to think, okay, all we can do is plan today. What do I feel today? What do I feel I can cope with today? What do I want to do? Who do I want to see? I think that's all we can do. And actually, you know, certainly my teenagers live like that. And there's probably nothing wrong with living like that. It's just we've all had to change to try and live like that.
That's exactly it, Nikki. Your 16-year-old self. What would she say? She'd say, get the shoes. Don't worry if you can't afford it. Get the shoes. Don't worry about it. Eat that now. Go for a run. Enjoy yourself. Stay up. Dance till dawn. Do it.
Oh, we need to do all of that today. That's so true, because tomorrow anything could happen, couldn't it? That's so true.
Absolutely.
And you've cheered everyone up here today, including myself and yourself, hopefully, because I'm sorry you had a terrible morning. And that's, you know, not great you had a terrible morning, if you know what I mean. It's great that we can illustrate to others, you can still have a terrible morning and then be uplifted and, you know, ups and downs in the day, and things can pick you up.
But this is what I love about your podcast. It isn't just send. It's not just an information. It's a chat. And it feels like you're having the chat when you listen. And I really like that. I think that's great. So when I'm feeling, I've listened to all of them, but it makes me feel like I'm involved.
Oh, thank you so much. And actually, we've had reviews like that. And please, to the listeners, do scroll down on Apple and give us a review. We've had a lot of 5-star reviews. I'm really touched about, and a lot of lovely compliments, but they've said it's been described as achingly human and real and conversational. You know, it's not sort of, you know, although we've been chatting about your book and your work and your life, it's actually been digging deeper because we love the emotional interaction of what's really happening and how do you really feel, so we can help others who feel differently with setbacks and challenges in their life, and hopefully, you know, if I can change their mindset, their day, their life, then that's what it's about, isn't it? Pay it forward. That is my mission. That is why I'm on this earth. Pay it forward is what we say. And amazing that you've been through everything you've been through. Thank goodness, come back from cancer and, you know, face the family issues you have. Bless you. So lastly, what key message would you give to inspire and influence women or men, because we have both listening now, to help them with their dreams and lives post-lockdown?
I think have the confidence to follow them, and don't dwell on the reasons why you can't, but draw a big list of all the reasons why you can and should.
Definitely draw up a bucket list. And I've read people are now very rudely calling it a fuck it list, and I'm totally relate to that.
Let's go with that.
Draw up one of those and do it now is what we say. Oh, thank you. Do take care of yourself. Thank you so much for sharing your amazing insights, sharing your writing, your work. Good luck with the new book. It's been lovely to chat to you today. Thank you for inspiring and uplifting other women and men today, and love to Josh and Simeon and the whole family.
Thank you, Nikki.
The Influential Women's Podcast is founded, hosted and exec produced by Nikki Bannerman and produced by Safran Mirza. Please keep listening for more podcast guests on our women's platform and download and share through the traditional podcasting platforms. Rate and review us on Apple to keep producing more episodes for you, and please reach out and talk to us. Contact us on Instagram at influential_women_podcast to share your views and thoughts and favourite shows with us and what you'd love to hear more about.